Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon. The Diane Rehm Show is carried on 197 stations across the country and reaches an audience of 2.5 million every week. After 40 years in radio, Ms. Rehm plans to retire at the conclusion of the 2016 presidential race. She's written a new memoir called On My Own, in which she recounts having to say goodbye to not only to radio, but to John, her husband of 54 years, after his lengthy and painful battle with Parkinson's disease, and how his struggle inspired her to become an activist for the Right to Die with Dignity movement. The book is published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased it has brought Diane Rehm back to our show. Hello.
Hi.
Now, most radio people never want to retire. Why have you decided that it's time for you?
You know, I'm not really going to retire. I'm stepping away from the microphone.
From the Daily Show.
Absolutely. I may, who knows, maybe do a podcast, but I'm going to help continue to support WAMU, public radio. I'm going to advocate publicly for the right to die after I step away from the microphone. I'm going to talk about the need for families to talk with each other about death. It's part of life, Leonard.
But you didn't want to step away before you learned how the 2016 election turns out.
Precisely.
Is it in your blood because you grew up in Washington?
I grew up in Washington, but I really didn't become politically tuned in until I started doing the show. And that truly turned me on, and I tuned in.
You've been covering politics for 4 decades. Doesn't this election feel rather unusual?
Unusual is not a word I would use.
Well, I was trying to be discreet.
I would say something like wacky. I don't get it. I really don't get it and don't understand exactly where the American voting public is right now.
Are you ever upset by the anti-Arab feelings that you hear from some of the politicians?
I think that what some of the politicians have said about Arabs, about Muslims, is not called for in this country.
Well, your background is Arab, but not Muslim. You were Orthodox.
Absolutely.
Christian?
That's
your family?
Right. That's right. My mother and father were both born in Mersin, Turkey, before Syria was even created. My father's family went to Beirut, Lebanon. My mother's family went to Alexandria, Egypt. I was born in this country.
You write that you met John when he was a legal advisor to your boss at the State Department.
Exactly.
How did you come to work as a secretary at the State Department? You hadn't gone to college.
Hadn't gone to college. Started out as the secretary at the D.C. Highway Department. Leonard.
Well, you were a radio dispatcher. Was that
exactly.
Some kind of omen?
You know, who knows? But my boss said to me, every day he'd walk in and say, Diane, get on the radio. Tell those guys they need to fix a pothole at 14th and K or whatever. I mean, and there it was. Then I was recruited to the Postal Inspection Service with a raise, and then the State Department recruited me. So I guess my shorthand and typing were good.
Some of your earliest conversations with John, you say, were about your mutual love for baseball. Weren't you playing second base for the State Department's women's softball team?
I was.
Did he also play?
He played pitcher for the men's softball team, and we got to talking about more than baseball.
Yeah, well, I'm sure. But that was when the Senators were still in Washington.
Senators were still in Washington. You know, Leonard, when I was a little girl growing up in Washington, I actually went to the home of the owner of the Washington Senators, Clark Griffith, for a Halloween begathon. And they invited me into his big study, and I met him. It was lovely.
On the other hand, he was notorious for his ideas about race, and one of the reasons I gather he moved to Minnesota was it was a very white city.
How did I know that?
Yes.
I was a little kid.
Now, your first dinner date with John, you say, was the result of a bet on who would win the World Series.
Exactly. I don't even remember who was up that year, but we did bet, and I won, and the bet was a dinner. So John pretty quickly invited me to one of the loveliest restaurants in Washington, Chef Francois. And we had a great dinner.
He was your second husband?
He was my second husband. I was married when I was 19 to an Arab man, lovely guy. But I think he expected me to be the same kind of wife his own mother had been, and I just wasn't cut out for it.
And John, you say, actually wanted to teach and not be a lawyer, and your relationship blossomed because you love learning from him.
I love learning from him. He was the best teacher I ever had.
And he served in both the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. Was he practicing law the whole time?
He was. He was a trade lawyer and helped to set up the office of the U.S. Special Trade Representative and then became its first attorney under Christian Herter, who had been, of course, governor prior to coming there.
Had he retired from practice when he got his Parkinson's diagnosis?
Yes, he had. You know, I really didn't want him to retire. I felt that 70 was too young for him to retire. But he was tired of the law, tired of the business of law, and so retired at age 71.
But that had to have been slightly odd, a retired husband with a wife who was working every day and was probably a lot more famous than he was.
Well, he had planned what he wanted to do. He studied to be a docent at the Freer and Sackler for a solid year. He became a reader for the blind and dyslexic and a volunteer at hospice. So for the first few years, it was perfect. He was out and about every day. We bought him a new car. He was so independent and having such a good time. And then he'd wait for me to come home for our nightly walks, and I began to hear a shuffle in
his walk. How much after he retired?
About 5 years.
So around 75.
Yeah, exactly.
My guest is Diane Rehm, who's been the host of the Diane Rehm Show, on WAMU in Washington, D.C. since 1979. She's written a memoir, her fourth book, third by herself. It's called On My Own. It's published by Knopf, and we'll continue our conversation after this. And we're back with Diane Rehm, who's written a memoir called On My Own. It's published by Knopf, your fourth book. Do you enjoy writing?
You know, writing doesn't come all that easily.
But you write for your show.
But, you know, I felt as though this was such an important book. I began writing it, Leonard. I think the night John was dying, I was in his room, trying to sleep on two chairs with my little dog on my stomach, couldn't sleep, got up at 2 a.m, took out my iPad, and just jotted down what I was feeling and what I was seeing. And I think that was really the start of it.
In 1998, you wrote Finding My Voice.
Right.
You didn't do that on the iPad. That was the first time you came on this show.
Exactly. And that was because I had lost my voice. I'm still getting periodic injections of Botox into my vocal cords. But thankfully, listeners have stayed with me all these years despite not having your smooth, dulcet tones.
You have what's called spasmodic dysphonia?
Exactly. And it
How common is that?
More common than you'd think. I get lots of emails from people around the country who have it. It begins in the basal ganglia of the brain, which sends an incorrect message to the vocal cords, telling them to clamp down inappropriately. And then I started getting this, and that's the beginning.
Well, you mentioned that John got you to quit smoking. Do you think that played a factor? Or?
Oh, gosh. You know, I smoked.
I've always wondered what would happen if I continued smoking, whether I'd have a better radio voice or a worse radio voice.
Do you smoke now?
No, I quit smoking in the 70s.
Okay. I smoked from the age of 15 to the age of 25. So I did not contract spasmodic dysphonia until 25 years later. I doubt seriously that that had anything to do with it. It is a neurological disorder.
You write that up until 1973, you were happy to be a homemaker, mother of two, but you knew you needed something more because your children were growing up?
They were.
Is that what got you into radio?
Absolutely. I got into radio as a volunteer. How did you get into radio?
Somebody called me and asked me if I wanted to do a show.
They liked your voice.
No, I knew something about black gospel music, so I wound up doing a gospel show.
There you
are. But it was very odd.
And mine was very odd. I mean, that's how we get into radio.
But you volunteered at WAMU, which is a university station, wasn't a member of NPR at the time.
Because you had to have 5 full-time employees to be a member of NPR. And when I began, there were 2, and that was about it.
And everybody else was a college student.
Exactly. That's how it started.
But then you wound up hosting your own show in
1979? Starting to host the show in 79. It was renamed in 1984 as the Diane Rehm Show and went national in 1995 and has been with NPR ever since.
You write that from the beginning of your broadcasting career, John was your greatest cheerleader. You had an extraordinary marriage, but not a perfect one.
Nobody has a perfect marriage, I don't believe, anyhow.
What were some of the challenges of your marriage?
Well, I think, don't get
into the sex in too much detail.
I promise the sex was great, but let me tell you about the rest. He needed silence and alone time far more than I did.
And you suggested he went into, he had dark moods at times.
Very dark moods. Needed to be alone. Once said that he'd rather have lunch with the New Yorker magazine than any human being alive, and I knew that included me.
Did writing your joint memoir Toward Commitment, a dialogue about marriage, help clear the air at all?
It did. It did. Each of us wrote our own take on, say, religion or money or raising children. Then we went away to our farm for 3 weeks and exchanged those essays. And Leonard, I'll tell you, we had some of the biggest fights during those 3 weeks you can possibly imagine. But we recorded it all. And then I, the perfect secretary, transcribed it all. And that's how we came up with Toward Commitment.
But you did it that way rather than going to a marriage counselor.
We did that too.
You begin the book with John's decision to die. When was, as you told us, he was first diagnosed with Parkinson's quite a while ago. And he had moved into Brighton Gardens, a facility in Chevy Chase in 2012.
Right.
What was involved in the decision to put him in an institution? Was it just too hard for him to get around?
He began falling. And so we had somebody stay with him during the day while I was at the office to prepare his meals, to help him dress. Finally, one morning at 3 a.m., when I was the only person there, John fell. And I don't know if you've ever tried to lift someone who cannot help him or herself. Mm.
It's very hard.
Nearly impossible. I finally got him to his knees and dragged him to the bed. And the next day, we talked. And he knew that the time had come. He was going to have to go into a facility. We simply did not have enough room in the condo to which we had moved to have someone there full time.
But he was also upset about the decision.
Well, he didn't show it. Hmm. He wouldn't show it. He took it stoically, as he did pretty much everything.
How often were you able to visit him there?
Pretty much every day after I left WAMU. I'd go straight there to Brighton Gardens to see him and be with him.
And how old was he at the time?
He died at age 84.
He decided to die, you have the exact date, June 14.
No, that's the day he began to...
Well, he actually wanted to do something to die.
And he finally died on June 23rd.
9 days later.
9 days later, actually 10 days later, having withdrawn from water, from medications, from food, he said, I am ready to die. And the doctors could not help him die. They could not give him a lethal dose of medication. That would have been against the law, against ethics, against everything that they believe in and are bound by in Maryland. So he took his own life. He relinquished his life by withdrawing from life.
His doctor, Dr. Freed, told him that the only way he could move forward with his decision was to refuse water, food, and medication. Was he in pain during those 10 days between the decision to stop eating and taking medication and
Leonard,
his death?
I was there every single day for those 10 days. I do not believe he was in pain. He was thirsty. His lips were dry. I put sponges into his mouth. I put lotion on his lips and face to try to help that. I do believe that John Rehm should have had the right to say, I'm ready to die. I want to die. Please help me die.
And that's why you've become a Right to Die activist.
Well, I, as you perhaps know, NPR has said to me, and my own station has said to me, I cannot advocate for the right to die and continue to host my daily show.
So they discourage your involvement with an organization called Compassion and Choices.
Exactly. Until I step away from the microphone at the end of the year.
You've been very encouraged by the Supreme Court of Canada in their support of physician-assisted suicide for patients suffering from grievous and irremediable medical conditions.
And California,
so could you have moved to Canada?
I could have, perhaps.
I'm not saying you should have, but is that one of the only options?
You would have had to, as you do in Oregon, you would have had to establish 3-month residence. Have two doctors determine that you are within 6 months of dying. So what I am hoping is that California, having voted to allow this for 10 years and then to reevaluate, that California may become the tipping point for states around the country.
You're right that after 54 years of marriage, you were worried about how you would cope on your own.
I was.
You watching more TV these days?
No. I'm out and about. I'm active. I do what I need to do and want to do. And I am far more comfortable being alone than I ever was before.
Although you do say you just turn it on TV for the comfort of voices. People keep radio or TV on.
Radio is what I leave on all day long.
Now, you quote Joan Didion on losing her husband, John Gregory, done so quickly, and you have friends who have lost their spouses suddenly. But this was a long process.
This was a long process. And if you were to ask me, which do you think is harder, to lose someone over a long period or quickly, I don't think anybody can make that decision. It's what's in your own heart.
Well, it hurts to lose somebody either way, but to watch somebody you love suffer is always quite painful.
And
I'm sure you've spoken to quite a few people, including, didn't you speak to Eleanor Clift, somebody we all know about in public radio?
I know her very well. In fact, when John was a volunteer for hospice, Eleanor Clift's husband asked that John come and read to him, which he did.
In 2014, when President Obama presented you with the National Humanities Medal, he said, in probing interviews with everyone from pundits to poets to presidents, Ms. Reem's keen insights and boundless curiosity have deepened our understanding of our culture and ourselves. You must have been very pleased, because I'm sure that was what, in the back of your mind, you were hoping you were doing.
Well, the announcement to me came 2 days after John's memorial service. All I could think, Leonard, was, I wish he were here. I wish he knew. I hope he knows. I hope he can see.
Over the course of your career, the involvement of your audience has expanded. I know it has for me when I started working on typewriters, and in our first offices, we actually had to go to a different floor to get faxes, and or somebody had to deliver them to us. And now we have tweets, Facebook comments on our show page. Do you feel that those things have improved the quality of shows?
Not necessarily. I think that the immediacy of the messages somehow gets through to us that much more quickly. We can still decide which tweets or which Facebook postings we want, and that's what makes us the broadcasters we are, is weeding out those things that make the program move forward and those that don't. I don't think it's necessarily improved it, but it's changed it in some ways.
Well, I find that the best feedback I ever get is just when I meet people, not when I read the comments page. The people who write to comments pages are the people who write to comments pages. Are you going to continue blogging?
I've never blogged.
Are you going to pick up blogging?
I may. You never know. I don't know. You know what I am going to do? I'm going to continue acting in a play for Us Against Alzheimer's, a play called Surviving Grace. I am a woman who falls into Alzheimer's.
The book On My Own is published by Knopf. And Diane, it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Fortune magazine began ranking the 500 largest U.S. corporations in 1955. Despite all the changes in our economy, politics, and culture in the 60 years since, remarkably few African Americans lead those top companies. In fact, unemployment is roughly twice as high for black men and women aged 25 to 54, while representation in many professions is lower. Some argue that education is the key, beginning in grade school and continuing through college. Journalist Ellen McGirt looks at the current trends and the reasons behind them in an article in the current issue of Fortune called Leading While Black, Why Race and Culture Matter in the C-Suite. I'm very pleased that it brings her to our show now, along with Richard Gray, Director of Community Organizing and Engagement at Brown University's Annenberg Institute for School Reform. Welcome to our show, both of you.
It's great to be here.
Thank you very much.
Ellen, how many black CEOs are currently heading Fortune 500 companies?
We don't have very many. We have five. One is Ursula Burns of Xerox, who's a woman. There have been 15 since we started keeping track of all of this stuff. And it's just not enough.
So you weren't keeping track 60 years ago when this whole thing began.
I wasn't keeping track, no.
I mean, but Fortune
my
wasn't.
Dad, no, but my dad was. You know, there's a whole generation of men who have not been even invited to consider that this was a career path for them.
Blacks form a greater percentage in Congress, in fact. Are American voters more open than corporate boards of directors to black leadership?
You know, I think that's an interesting question. I think it's really an apples and oranges kind of situation. If you're looking for representation that's close to your community, close to your zip code, then Congress makes a lot of sense. That is a local voice talking about local matters. If you're talking about a universal voice, someone who has to deal with boards, who has to deal with global business trends, has a much broader operational understanding of how the world works, I think you're going to get into some trouble.
How much concern is there over the lack of black CEOs? Do companies view this as a problem that needs addressing?
You know, I don't know how to answer that honestly. I think diversity and diverse talent in the pipeline is something that everybody talks a lot about, and they talk about it with real earnestness and seriousness and urgency. Business has changed dramatically. We have entire categories of work that are brand new in the last few years with skills and opportunities that are very hard to quantify, and the skill sets and the experience that you would need to be good at those jobs are very hard to quantify. But when it comes specifically about race, that's a more difficult conversation to have.
Richard, Ellen just mentioned that Ursula Burns at Xerox is one of the exceptions. She was raised by a single mother in the Baruch houses on Manhattan's Lower East Side, but haven't you expressed concerns about making a lot of that kind of story of a child rising from poverty to success?
I think that's a great question. There is sort of this beat the odds type of dynamic that is created that gives the sense that if there's a person who makes it, if that person can make it, anybody can make it. And while we have many examples of people who strive and succeed in spite of, I think if we look at the data, it shows that systemically there aren't as many opportunities for those kinds of success stories. And one of the things that we fail to recognize when we look at that is that one person probably represents the tip of the iceberg of people who have that kind of capacity and skill. They were just able to make it through a very narrow opening.
Is there a different story that might serve better to inspire children in poor minority communities, or a story that could better inform policymakers?
Yeah, I think there's still ways to be able to use those stories in ways that, rather than just highlighting the individual, to look back and say, well, what were the circumstances and what were the conditions that created that opportunity? And what you'll see in many cases is that there will be supports, resources, relationships that existed for this person that allowed them to succeed that don't exist for other kids. And that could be an implication for the kinds of systemic changes we need to make those kinds of supports more available to other students.
Richard, I just want to jump in there and add on to what you were saying, because you certainly taught me a lot as I was reporting this piece. Of the two dozen people that I interviewed about their lives, there were some real remarkable similarities. And I've also profiled Ursula Burns, who's a person I really admire. And she talked to me a lot about her childhood. And she told me an extraordinary story of coming home one day and her mother's angry, holding the door open, holding a hairbrush, actually, and that she had been reported by one of the neighbors that she didn't cross the street properly. And that was an awakening of a moment for her where she understood that she mattered to her community, and it was awakening of empathy and that people were investing in her. And I get goosebumps when I remember that story. Every single executive who was successful that I had interviewed, almost without fail, had a parent, a father who was a pastor or a small business owner or somebody in their life who was an educator who had real mastery of the system in front of them. But they had people who, they had black men in particular, but people in their community who were counting on them and who also were successful and respected.
And I suspect that, you won't find as many stories of that sort with most of the other CEOs of top corporations.
I don't think it's a necessary ingredient.
But are the corporate numbers better when you look at whole management teams?
You know, they're improving, and it's industry by industry, I would imagine, but not enough. Research has found that there are two key areas where black executives are going to be left behind. And these are tough transition points for everybody. And one is the transition from individual contributor to first-time leader. Dave Thomas, the dean of the business school at Georgetown, has extraordinary research that shows how much longer it takes black executives to get there. It really slows down momentum. It certainly would cost their families a great deal. And then there's that pre-C-suite executive bench where you are maybe the master of your business unit, but you don't have operational knowledge yet because you don't have the network in place, you don't have the opportunities in place, and because it's taken you longer to get there, maybe you haven't had an overseas assignment or whatever it was going to take to make you successful.
How do things look at smaller companies?
You know, I think this is a place for real optimism, particularly if there are black executives who have started the company. Black entrepreneurship is an area of real optimism. I spoke with Derek Ferguson, who's the CEO of Revolt. It used to be Bad Boy Entertainment. It was Sean Combs' outfit. And he really believes, he came from an entrepreneurial family, and he really believes in the entrepreneurship vision, particularly now there's so many social tools, technology tools that can get people up to speed and competitive very quickly. And his point of view is, you're not going to get the next great idea out of a big corporation that's run by a traditional structure because it's just moving too slowly.
Now, is there a path to the corner office, a way for an aspiring executive to strategize whatever his or her ethnicity?
All of the good stuff that people know to do, which is to become, bring yourself to the attention of people in power.
Learn how to stab others in the back and all of that.
You know, that works for a certain cohort. I wouldn't recommend it for the workplace in the future. I have seen it myself. But, you know, align the work that you do to the bottom line of the company. Really, you know, make sure that you understand how the company makes money and how you are relevant within that is the kind of advice that I'm seeing all executives get, but black executives in particular. Go ahead, Richard.
I was going to say that there's some interesting in reading Alan's article, and Alan and I have known each other for a number of years. We went to Brown University together. There's some interesting parallels to this notion of how people of color access rarefied and elite institutions. That I was struck by the culture, and we've talked about access, but once you get there, you have to stay there, and you have to succeed, and you have to navigate the culture. And even the idea of once you're in to try to build a pipeline for others to come through sometimes can be counter to the culture. I've been in environments where someone will say, well, you know, you want to mentor people within this environment. Why are you mentoring Jamal and not Chip? And there's this sense that even bringing sort of a racial component to how do I build a pipeline and mentor people to come and stay here can be counter to some of the elite cultures where it does not exist for, say, a network of people who go to Brown together or a network of people who are part of the same fraternity. There are these different parts of the culture where you build sort of a network of support. Race has not been a part of that, a part of that, the categories that people, once you get in, you can sort of build a way to support others who are coming behind you.
Is there any evidence on how a black CEO affects recruitment of Hispanics or Asians?
There's not a lot of data, at least not a lot of data that I'm aware of, and I wish there was. All throughout I call it the talent pipeline from birth to C-suite, we're missing opportunities to study where we're losing people of color or anybody who's not part of the mainstream.
Do black men face different hurdles than black women or all women in general?
Richard, you want to start?
Yeah, I think that they're different. And I think that's been one of the dynamics around a lot of the research that's been done and a lot of the work that's been done about the investment and the success and issues for black males in education, the My Brother's Keepers, that there are There's data that shows, for example, there's a high rate of suspensions for black males, but there's also a similar high rate of suspension for black females. I think the dynamics are different. I wouldn't say that it's less of an issue. I just think that some of the issues that black males face in environment are tied sometimes to dynamics of how they're viewed, the issue of being threatening. Mm-hmm. This issue of the angry black man is something that comes up, and I was really struck in your article by you want to be aggressive but not too aggressive, and I can see that as being a very challenging thing to do in a corporate environment where being aggressive is sort of a part of the culture, but you have to balance that with sort of a racial lens, and I think sometimes it's viewed differently for men and for women. But I think the pressures are and the barriers are equally difficult.
Yeah, I agree. I think for being cast as the angry black woman is more annoying than threatening. It certainly has been speaking from my experience. Yeah.
Are there some professions or industries where blacks are particularly underrepresented or perhaps more likely to be represented? I'd imagine that entertainment and sports are more welcoming than, I don't know, oil companies.
You know, exactly. And I think I may have overemphasized the technology sector in the piece simply because it's so galling because these are new companies and they are magical, shiny, amazing companies that are connecting the world, the Twitters and the Facebooks and the Googles, and they're so vastly underrepresented.
And Bloomberg Business ran a story a couple of weeks ago about why Silicon Valley isn't hiring black coders. Did you see that?
I did. It was a great story because it really spoke to the culture inside the bubble, which is the inclusive part. It's just not a welcoming culture.
Blacks make up about 13% of the U.S. population, but 1% or less of the technological workforce at Google, Facebook, and other tech companies. And NPR reported this morning on successful efforts by Intel to recruit women and people of color, but other tech firms haven't been very open. Is there also a transparency problem here?
There is, and Google deserves some credit. I had a really good interview with David Drummond over at Google, and they led the way with the numbers, and they are really serious about bias training, and they're serious about recruiting, and they're serious about helping be ambassadors for especially people who are coming out of the historically black colleges to have a good experience there. But it's going to take a while to see how it goes.
According to the Bloomberg article, firms weren't recruiting at predominantly African-American colleges like Howard. Are sources of black talent being overlooked?
It is. And Richard, I'll jump in here too. They have been. There's a long and poignant history of, say, the auto industry recruiting very successfully from HBCUs, which has made a huge difference. Now HBCUs seem to be the one big idea everybody has in technology, which is great. I just don't think that's the only place to look.
Richard, Intel spokespeople said claims about a lack of black candidates are overstated, but they're still having problems with retention and with accommodating diverse cultural views among workers.
Mm. That's an interesting dynamic, and it's strange because, you know, 53, and I think it's the same thing that we've been hearing about both corporate and college institutions, that there's a dynamic in the culture. And I think we just did a recent study in Boston on black and Latino male success in schools. And one of the dynamics that is a factor for success is just the ability to even talk about race in the context of the environment, that it creates an environment that's not only conducive for the black and Latino students, it also creates an opening for many of their white counterparts and colleagues to be able to talk about competencies that they don't have. You know, very often it's a frightening thing to have a conversation about race for white people. And so if there's a way for us to create that dialogue, it allows for things to come out in a way that's both facilitated and supports relationships rather than it just coming out in a way that can be destructive because it's not we're not even addressing it, and it comes out in a way that's either angry or destructive.
I'm speaking with Richard Gray, Director of Community Organizing and Engagement at Brown University's Annenberg Institute for School Reform, and with Ellen McGirt, whose article Leading While Black, Why Race and Culture Matter in the C-Suite is in the current issue of Fortune magazine. Stay with us for more. We're back with Ellen McGirt, whose article in the current issue of Fortune magazine is Leading While Black, Why Race and Culture Matter in the C-Suite, and Richard Gray, Director of Community Organizing and Engagement at Brown University's Annenberg Institute for School Reform. How do young African Americans seeking work respond to a workplace where only one in 100 people is black? Can we generalize about that?
We probably can't, but I'm going to. It's my job. I think that the younger generation that I am talking to is approaching this with a lot of trepidation, and it falls into two camps. One is, I'm willing to give this a shot, but not overinvest in it because I don't feel seen. I don't feel like I belong. And the other one is what I talked about in the piece. I interviewed four extraordinary young men who decided, that's it, I'm out. Corporate America is not for me. I have the tools to succeed. I have my own network, and it's powerful. And I can be entrepreneurial and creative and still make money and have a family.
So people who might have become CEOs and if they were white are starting their own companies because they feel like the path is kind of blocked for them? Or just because they feel uncomfortable in an environment that's not of their own making?
Both. That they feel that they are, that they're tokens or they're representing or they're not, they're going to have to turn themselves into someone they're not in order to fit into the culture.
Rich, whatever happened to that post-racial society people were talking about after Barack Obama was elected?
I think that was, I'm still trying to figure that one out myself. I mean, I think the post-racial is actually just a different racial conversation. And I think about I have a son who's 15, and I remember when Barack Obama was elected. And, you know, for me, it was a very moving and emotional point. I never thought that I would ever see this in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. But then I looked at my son, who was at the time was 6 years old, and he looks at me as if to say, Richard, Dad, you know, half the presidents in my lifetime have been black. And they actually liked the black one better than the white one. And so there was this dynamic with him around race that was very different. And I put that out to say that what we have now is a very different and should have a very different conversation about race. One of the things that we found in our Black and Latino study is that by saying black and Latino, you really overlook the diversity in both of those terms. We found that a large portion of the students who identify as black were originally from the Caribbean or from the continent, mm-hmm. and we're seeing a growing change in what it means to be black and Latino. And so one of the things that I think is a positive is that we should have a conversation where all of us, including us as black people, are students of race, where we've shifted from looking at race as we did as a black and white television when I was 6 years old to now a high-definition color television, that there are lots of nuances. And I think that's important to recognize that even by saying you have an environment that's open to black people, unless we look at those nuances, you can actually overlook large parts of people's culture and context by not looking at that diversity.
A couple of years ago, President Obama launched the My Brother's Keeper initiative. What was that intended to accomplish, and have we seen any changes as a result?
You know, that was, and Richard, I want you to jump in on this as well. I talked to Jim Shelton, who was the Deputy Secretary of Education, and who launched it. He's gone on to do other things. The original intent, and we're seeing such a bolt of excitement in the community that cares about black and brown boys and men, was to really point the finger at and look for solutions as to where we're losing, where the experience of black boys and men in their communities. Richard, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that was really exciting about that is that there was a conversation about, you know, what is the kind of context that's necessary to have success for students and for black and Latino males in all contexts. And one of the things that I think was in your article, Ellen, that is a central part of it is this notion of relationship.
Yep.
That for many of the students, the reason we are losing them in school settings and other settings is a disconnect. They are in institutions or in environments that they do not feel any kind of connection to. And that, and often if you look at that, there's a lack of relationships that give this institution some sort of context. And so the emphasis on building relationships with people that I think is central to that initiative is, I think, central to the dynamic that we're talking about here, that you have to figure out ways of being able to do it. One of the places that's doing it very successfully in an academic setting is Oakland, California. They have a superintendent that is focused on African-American male success. And I think that's one of the really important things. It shifted from this notion of a deficit model to one that says this institution has to be invested in the success of students, and they created a whole new culture and environment that's embedded in the system that's about building relationships between those young men and the institution around a notion of success.
Ellen, you write that numbers, quote, don't capture the frustration that many black executives feel as they try to thrive and compete in a realm where race is often seen as an asterisk on their resumes. This is why some black conservatives get upset when there's talk about affirmative action.
I'm sure there are many reasons why black conservatives get upset, and I can only understand some of them. But
what frustrations are you talking about for the people you're discussing in that?
That their job is to be the representative in the room.
They're the token.
That they are the token. And then a big part of their jobs, which is why they lose momentum during their careers, is to then go to diversity fairs and show up on diversity panels and talk about the experience of being themselves at work instead of doing the work that raises the revenue for the company they're working for.
Richard, you studied law at Berkeley and lecture at Columbia Law School. Do you see similar frustrations among black lawyers or college or law students?
Yeah, absolutely. I just participated in a conversation with a number of faculty and black students about this very same dynamic for them, that there is a and I think this is something we haven't talked about, but there is almost this dual duty that you have as a person of color in these contexts. You're not only have to go about the very difficult task of either studying to become a lawyer, trying to thrive in a corporate environment, but there's also this notion that you have this sense of responsibility, and you have to take on this other burden of helping people to understand that you're just trying to do the same thing that they're doing, and do it in an environment where you're often viewed as questioning whether you should be there in the first place. And I know a number of students talk about the idea of this notion that people think they got in there not through merit, but through some sort of affirmative action program. And I always tell them the same thing that I said, because I had that same dynamic. Affirmative action may get you in, but it doesn't get you out. And no matter how you get into that environment, what you do and what you do afterwards really is most important. So you can't get caught up in that dynamic. And this notion of merit is one where, you know, I was next to a guy that, you know, got in because his father and mother went to that institution. So I think we have to sort of deconstruct this notion of whether or not it's important how you get into an environment. What's more important is what you do with that opportunity. And so I think creating relationships with students to have that dialogue is really critical so that they can sort of work through that on their own rather than doing it in a sort of isolation and in a context that doesn't put it in some sort of historical
framework.
Or
in a defensive crouch.
Well, yeah. We no longer hear phrases like he's a credit to his race, but is there still that a feeling of that kind of pressure?
I think there is, absolutely. And I know that at six, when I was bused to a school, I'm doing arithmetic, but I'm also feeling like if I screw up this question, you know, it's going to screw it up for black people who come after me. I mean, there is this thing that is on us, and I think part of it is not, it never really goes away, but I do think you begin to figure out that you're not the only one doing it. And I think one of the shifts that I think is really important for us, and it's why, you know, the community organizing is so important to us, is people need to know that they're not going through these same kinds of these things alone. And so how do you create communities of support that allow for us to say, yes, I've got this burden, but I don't have it alone. And so figuring out how to address it, I can do it in a collective with other people, allows me to give some of that burden to them. Sometimes I can get some support from them. And so I think going from the individual to the collective support is critical for a lot of these settings, so that people at least at some point can sort of take a breath and say, help, you know, I need some help with this right now. Can you help me? And they can, in turn, do that for others.
I'm speaking with Richard Gray, Director of Community Organizing and Engagement at Brown University's Annenberg Institute for School Reform, and Ellen McGirt, whose article in the current issue of Fortune is Leading While Black, Why Race and Culture Matter in the C-Suite, the C-Suite being the corner suite where the CEO's office is located.
Yes.
This is, I'm not located in a corner office. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Ellen, as you mentioned earlier, you spoke with some African-American executives and business people, and you interviewed Bernard Tyson, who is not with a Fortune 500 company, but is the CEO of a major institution, Kaiser Permanente. What happened to him when he was promoted to be the head of one of Kaiser's hospitals?
You know, Bernard told a story which is the signature story of where we might have lost him. He now, you know, has 180,000 employees, $60 billion in revenue, big, big, big company, just not eligible to be on the Fortune 500. And it was when he was switching to a job that was going to give him real operational achievements. A beautiful hospital in Santa Rosa, his medical partner who was going to be running the hospital with him, a person who we ended up having a great relationship with, was adamantly against everything he was and stood for. He called it a guess who's coming to dinner sort of welcome. 1992, you know, this was not that long ago, and it was the courage of this individual to admit to him on a walk that he was unable to deal with working with a black peer. He didn't have this experience. He didn't know. It was triggering all these race and power and status anxieties in him. And that conversation, they were able to manage that conversation and then move ahead. And now Bernard's the CEO. But Bernard has also been able to scale those learnings. You know, how you can let everybody be who they are when they come to work, and challenge power and talk to each other about how to get along.
It wasn't all that long ago. Just was reading about Lena Horne doing a television show in which written into her contract was that she would not touch even the arm of any of her guests.
Oh, good Lord.
So,
we act like
assuming that white
mystery.
Executives aren't racist, is there a way to open up the discussion when we come out of a situation like that?
You know, it really comes from the top. There's the new shiny thing is bias training, which is a reboot of several things that have happened in the past. And although there's reasons to be skeptical that this is going to work, particularly if it's not really baked into the culture from the top over a long period of time, there's lots of reasons to be optimistic, particularly because we're seeing so many outside influences. That can we teach people a common language to talk about what is invisible to them, about how they choose team members, how they choose projects, how they advance people, how they give feedback? And the evidence supports that if you teach somebody that they have a blind spot, they will course correct.
Ellen Pao, who is Chinese-American, accused venture capital company Kleiner, Perkins, Caulfield, and Byers of discrimination, and the company won in court, but some think that it lost in public. Are public attitudes changing, and is there an increasing pressure on business?
When it comes to this, I am optimistic, but not hopeful.
Well, Fortune did write your publish your article.
It was, and they came to me with it. It was not something that I had even pitched, and I am thankful to my editor Cliff Leaf every day for this opportunity to dig in. But I'm optimistic. But the hopeful part, if we're not able to build systems where people can have meaningful conversations about things that embarrass and upset them, like perhaps they have a problem with a fill-in-the-blank kind of person, we will never get all the way there.
Richard, another of the black Fortune 500 CEOs, Rodney O'Neill of Delphi Automotive, has said that his parents strongly emphasized education. How well is the current educational system serving African Americans, and is that one of the big problems in what we're discussing?
Absolutely a big problem. I think we've invested more resources in education, I think we've seen over the last few years, particularly with the downturn, economic downturn, a massive disinvestment in public education, and the people that are affected by that are largely communities of color and poor communities, and where education was once seen as an opportunity and a step up for people in certain communities. It's increasingly we're finding that not only in K-12, but we're seeing a massive cuts at the, you know, here in New York City, we have the city university system that if you look at to a number of people in generations, they were able to go to college and be able to move on because of that access to public higher ed. And so I think there needs to be a massive reinvestment in that. And I think that's really mostly around public will.
But college enrollment is highest among Asians, with about 60% of Asians between 18 and 24 years old in college, compared with about 40% of white Americans. Some people might assume that Asians are doing fine as CEOs, but they're not getting those jobs either.
Right.
So there are other factors here. It's not just education.
That's true.
Well, I think one of the things is the education is not the only factor. It's never been the only factor. I do think one thing that is happening that's different now is the massive amount of debt and high cost of even going to college makes the calculus of even going to college a more difficult one. I struggle to think if I could have afforded Brown University now rather than 30 years ago. And what we're seeing is a real I still think the value of education is important, but I also think that the cost of it is going up so high that it's become unattainable for a number of people.
But if you're looking at the pipeline, though, I mean, we have to acknowledge that a 10-year-old boy walking into the school system is going to be seen as a threat and a problem to solve and to be managed, and he's going to be disproportionately punished for the exact same behavior. And that has a real impact. So when you look at the numbers of people who are eligible even to join a Fortune 500 company, be part of the pipeline, the number is lower from the very beginning because they're not coming out of the school system that we supposedly designed to protect them and to teach them intact. And that's a real tragedy.
One of the young men that you spoke with, Darian Wickfall, was a scientist at Washington University School of Medicine. What attitudes did he find coworkers had toward him?
You know, he's very polite to say that there was he went to Mizzou, which of course is very famous for the boycott recently. So it's a racist system where he went to college, and he feels that it's embedded into the system. And he certainly didn't feel that it was. I'm struggling to find the right phrase that he used to describe it, where he wouldn't necessarily pull out one person specifically for calling him a name or blocking his path. He felt that the system itself didn't see who he was or invest in his potential.
And Richard, you went to law school. Don't most law school graduates wind up going to into law firms? Do we see similar kinds of situations with black graduates?
I actually thought that when I went to law school, I wanted to be a civil rights attorney for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And I realized how many people go to law school and actually don't practice. And one of the things that's been interesting in the course that I'm teaching is the number of particularly students of color who are trying to navigate what we're talking about right now, where they're saying, I may go into a corporate environment, but I want to figure out how can I be my fullest self in whatever context that I go into. And I think one of the things that law school helped prepare me for, because I had a number of mentors that helped me think about navigating the transition, is that it helps prepare you to be able to deal in a hostile environment. I mean, we go to school to argue, and we go to school to persuade. And so I think part of it is really figuring out what are the tools that young people need to be able to navigate different environments, know that they have choices, have relationships for them. And I know that was true for me. I always viewed many of these environments as being hostile environments, but I had a real strong community of support that allowed for me to be able to figure out how to navigate that. And when I was beaten down, I knew I could go to them and get rejuvenated. And I think one of the things we need to build and invest in is what are those community supports that we have for people as they're going into these environments.
I've been speaking with Richard Gray, Director of Community Organizing and Engagement at Brown University's Annenberg Institute for School Reform, and Ellen McGirt, whose article in the current issue of Fortune magazine is Leading While Black, Why Race and Culture Matter in the C-Suite. Thank you both so much for being on our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Moses Calhoun was one of the few slaves who received an education, and he used that advantage to become a successful businessman and a pillar of Atlanta's black community in the period after the Civil War. His great-granddaughter was singer and actress Lena Horne. Lena Horne's daughter, Gail Lamette Buckley, tells the story of her extraordinary family in a new book called The Black Calhouns, From Civil War to Civil Rights with One African-American Family. It's published by Atlantic Monthly Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Gail Lamette Buckley back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Your great-great-grandfather, Moses, was a house slave, and he got his last name from the slave owner. Did your family refer to themselves as the Black Calhouns?
Well, they didn't use black until the 80s, but they certainly were very proud of being owned, if I can put it that way, by a cousin of John C. Calhoun.
Who served as vice president under both John Quincy Adams and Andrew Jackson.
And who was an arch racist.
Yes. Well, he was a Southerner.
Yes.
Well, so was Andrew Jackson, an arch racist, but John Quincy Adams actually had a pretty good record when it came to African slaves.
Yes, but
if I remember my history correctly.
Yes, exactly. John C. Calhoun was a great apologist for slavery.
How did Moses happen to be one of the few slaves who could read and write?
Because his owner, a man called Dr. Andrew Bonaparte Calhoun, wanted a sophisticated butler, a slightly sophisticated butler. He wanted him to know how to read and write and run his household properly, which my great-great-grandfather did.
But wasn't it considered a crime in the South to educate slaves?
It was a total crime, but because Andrew Bonaparte Calhoun was so important, he was allowed to get away with it. But when my great-great-grandfather taught his mother and sister how to read, that was a crime. He was never accused of it or anything. He got away with it. But if anybody had known, it would have been a crime.
Did it matter that they were in Atlanta and not in on some plantation?
Yes, it totally mattered. Atlanta was It was not an agricultural society. It was a business society, and it was very lucky if you were a slave to be in a city or a town rather than in the country, because you were exposed to other slaves. You were exposed to education, and Andrew Bonaparte Calhoun was relatively benevolent, considering. So they were lucky.
So after the Civil War.
After the Civil War.
How did Moses use his skills as a butler?
He opened a restaurant catering service. He had a small hotel. He was helped, I think, by his owner. And he became a businessman.
But this is before segregation became the rule, before
absolutely.
Jim Crow.
This
so he might have served both whites and blacks?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And he was totally... He interacted with both communities.
And then he was very aware of upward mobility. He made sure his daughters were educated well.
Yes.
So they could marry well.
And education was primary to him. And they were educated beautifully at Atlanta University. And they both married well, both of his daughters, and moved north, of course, at the turn of the century.
Why did so many of the so-called talented 10th move north?
Because there were no opportunities in the South. Except
because Jim Crow had then become institutionalized?
Because after the end of Reconstruction, which was circa 1870, it was a nightmare in the South.
Moses' daughter Cora and her husband Edwin Horne were among those who went north, first to the Columbus Circle area of Manhattan?
Yes, that was the black area then. It was called, after 1898, it was called San Juan Hill. Because of the Spanish-American War.
That's where Thelonious Monk was born.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, it was where it was called San Juan Hill because the black troops had served with Teddy Roosevelt in the Spanish-American War.
There also had been a black community in the area that became Central Park. Everybody was thrown out of
yes,
that area.
Yes, to build Pennsylvania Station, I do believe. But the original black community was in the Village.
But then they moved to Brooklyn. Why Brooklyn?
Because they were raising four sons, and they felt it was a safer, better place for their children. It was still relatively bucolic in Brooklyn. And in the West 60s, which was the black area, was lively. It was sort of like Harlem, a precursor of Harlem. There was a great hotel there where all the musicians went, where jazz really was born in New York. And the tourists went there, and it was a great nightlife place. As Harlem became, and they wanted it more sedate, more family, at least my great-great-grandmother did.
So they moved to Stuyvesant Heights. Was that an integrated neighborhood in the 1890s?
Yes, it was. It was definitely. It was an enclave for middle-class blacks, but it was also an integrated neighborhood. Their street, Chauncey Street at the time, there were Irish, there were Swedish, and there were blacks.
Edwin Horn was a Republican activist journalist, not surprising, because the Republican Party in those days was it was the party of Lincoln.
Yes.
But then he switched party affiliations, became a leader in the Democratic
Party.
Yes,
because he got to New York and saw where the power was. It was Tammany, and he became a member of Black Tammany. And he wrote pamphlets in the 1912 election, which caused the black male vote, which was the only black vote there was, to vote Democratic for the first time. So there was a black governor for the first time because of my great-grandfather and the pamphlets he wrote.
And then his wife, Cora, was active in the NAACP and also was a suffragette?
Yes, and she was an active Republican. She scorned Tammany. And she became as soon as she got the vote, she became a Republican activist.
Well, the NAACP was formed to some degree in response to things like Birth of a Nation.
Absolutely.
And isn't it interesting that a new film called Birth of a Nation is now the big sensation?
Yes.
Have you seen it?
No, I'm eager to see it, I must say.
So Cora didn't share her husband's political affiliations?
No, they had a difficult marriage.
During this time, many members of your extended family were still living in the South. Was their experience very different?
Well, strangely enough, they had wonderful lives. I was looking for them to not have such wonderful lives. They had wonderful lives because they were once again educated middle-class people. And the black men in the South who were fortunate enough to be doctors or businessmen did not interact with the white element that was against them. Because the power structure of Atlanta did not want black advancement in certain areas, but they permitted it in terms of business.
In fact, the black enterprises thrived in Atlanta in a way that they didn't pretty much anywhere else in the country.
Yes, probably more than New York. Absolutely.
Cora and Edwin had four sons, mm-hmm. including your grandfather, Teddy.
Yes.
Would you say that Teddy was the family's embarrassment?
He was not an embarrassment. He was the black sheep. But he was not
an embarrassment. I'm always afraid to use
that. the brown
in this
sheep.
Context.
Yes. But he was he made money.
He was a gambler.
He was a gambler, and he sent his brothers through college and helped my mother support her. So I mean, and sent his mother, my great grandmother, on a grand tour of Europe. So he was not an embarrassment.
But
they adored him.
He was tainted to some degree by a connection to the 1919 Black Sox scandal.
He made a killing on that, a small killing.
He must have known the fix was in.
I don't know how he knew, but he made a pretty big killing on the Black Sox scandal. And all of his best friends were black numbers kings, most of whom had been World War I Army officers. So it was a strange mixture.
What did his father and mother, who were establishment figures, think of all of this?
Well, his mother was outraged. His mother was appalled. On the other hand, he knew how to make her happy by sending her money to take care of things and to go to Europe for her favorite charities or whatever she was doing. He was supporting her.
He married a woman named Edna, and
yes.
they had one child.
Yes.
What was Edna like?
Edna was what was called Edna Scottrin. Her family was very important in Brooklyn. They were black Republicans. Her father or her grandfather was the third black member of the Brooklyn Board of Education. He owned a big hardware store. He had patents on inventions. They were strict, typical middle class, and they had come from Springfield, Massachusetts as a family. So they had never been slaves. The Scottrins had never been slaves. But she wanted to be an actress. So both of my mother's parents deserted her, basically.
They weren't very good parents.
Terrible, terrible.
And they only had one child, and that was Lena.
They only had one child, Lena, and they divorced instantly.
So who raised Lena?
Her grandmother, Cora, and Edwin, and her grandfather.
But then her mother took her away.
Her mother took her back. Her mother took her away for a few years to the South, where she was acting in touring tent shows. That was the only work she could get. And then, I mean, her...
And she would leave her with acquaintances.
With acquaintances.
Watch my kid while I'm doing this.
Exactly. And finally, her grandmother and her father put an end to it and brought her back to Brooklyn. But then her mother, because her mother ran off to Cuba with a Cuban military officer, it's a very dramatic story, actually, ran off to Cuba and didn't come back until 1933, which was the year that Cora died. Took my mother out of girls' high school, which she adored, and put her in the Cotton Club. Now, this is the sort of paradox. If she had not been taken, whipped out of school, there never would have been Lena Horne. But everybody was very upset at the time, especially my mother. She hated it. But she got used to the Cotton Club, and that was fun for a while.
Well, had she been tempted at all by show business when she was in the South with her mother?
Well, in the South, there was no opportunity. But the minute she got back to New York, there was something called the Junior Debs in Brooklyn, which was a middle-class group which put on shows. And my mother was taken to the theater by her grandfather to see Fred Astaire in Gay Divorce and asked for singing and dancing lessons. Got singing and dancing lessons because she fell in love with Fred Astaire and became the star of the Junior Deb shows, singing Cole Porter and Harold Arlen at the age of 15 and singing at all the Junior Deb teas. And she wanted to go into show business, but she didn't know it was going to be the Cotton Club.
My guest is Gail Lamet Buckley. Her latest book, The Black Calhouns, From Civil War to Civil Rights, with one African-American family. When I say her latest book, are you surprised? I mean, would you have been surprised 20 years ago?
Well, yeah, I am such a sort of, I have such long periods between books that it's really funny. I mean, I don't consider myself an author. I mean, I do now, but I mean, my first book was like 1986. My second book was the 1990-something. Now, here I am with this one. And I'm retiring now.
This is it? Three books and you're out.
Three books, yes.
What was it like for a 16-year-old to be in the chorus of the Cotton Club?
Well, her mother was there every night. And she was protected by the black mob because of
Teddy, her father would have connections there.
Yes, absolutely. And she would beg her mother, please let me go Lindy hopping at the Renaissance Ballroom with all the other girls. And her mother would say no. So she really didn't like it. But she learned a lot.
What happened to her career when she married at 19 and had a child named Gail?
Well, her career was ostensibly over, except that her husband, who was my father, a high-stakes gambler himself for bridge, high-stakes bridge, liked the money. So he didn't mind her going into show business again, but he did not want her having any recognition. So it was a very difficult marriage. And he had another lady in his life who he'd always had. And she was much younger. So that marriage was doomed to failure, I'm sad to say, after the birth of my baby brother, who was a reconciliation child.
Then Lena had an experience at Cafe Society. Now, Barney Josephson had a really long career, long enough to have been a guest on this show many years ago.
I loved Barney. My mother loved Barney. He was a most wonderful man.
It was called a political nightclub?
I don't know if it was called officially a political nightclub, but it was definitely, I think it was called a political nightclub.
Unlike the Cotton Club, it was integrated.
Oh, yes, totally integrated.
The Cotton Club, many people have pointed out the irony was that although all the performers were black.
In a black neighborhood.
In Harlem, if a black customer came in, they were relegated to segregated seating.
Yes, it's in the kitchen, near the kitchen, and very few blacks were allowed in. My grandfather was allowed in because of his connections. It was a totally mob-run enterprise, the Cotton Club. Oney Madden and Legs Diamond and those people owned it. But the Cafe Society was political. Yes, it was. It was actually to raise money for the Communist Party, USA. And Barney was a communist.
At that time.
At the time. My mother didn't know a communist from a Republican. And they educated her in the sense about racism, which she had not been educated.
He also encouraged her to sing blues, add blues to her repertoire.
Yes.
This was not within her thinking.
No, her audition songs for Cafe Society were Sleepy Time Down South and Argentina Way, and Barney went ballistic. He said, you can't sing a song about the South. You can't sing a song about Down Argentina Way. People will think you're trying to pass. She had no idea. She was an innocent.
Well, she could almost pass. Part of her appeal was that she was lighter skinned than most of the black performers.
Yeah, she was not, and she didn't. She was very much because she'd worked with Noble Sissle, who was a very it was called Society Music, which was black musicians playing white music, and he wanted her to be like that. And that's how she learned. That's the way she learned to sing.
Black bourgeoisie disapproved of the blues.
Absolutely, she never heard the blues at home.
She was signed by MGM in 1942, but wasn't she the first black performer to sign with a major studio?
Yes, to have a long-term contract.
What kinds of roles was she offered?
She had no roles. She only could sing, and all of her scenes would be cut out of the picture when it played in the South.
So they didn't give her any lines that really mattered toward the plot?
No, only in two movies did she have lines that mattered to the plot, in Cabin in the Sky and Stormy Weather, which were all black. If it was an all-black cast, they were fine in the South. If it was a white picture and they weren't playing a servant, she had to be cut out.
Didn't the NAACP get involved in all of this?
They were totally involved and involved in her contract and in her career. And she, in her contract, it was stipulated she could not play servants, she could not be in jungle movies. And a lot of the black character actors in Hollywood who played those parts hated her and had a big meeting blasting her for this.
Because they felt she was going to lead to their not being offered roles as servants anymore.
Exactly, exactly.
When she was screen tested for a role as a maid, didn't her father meet with the folks at MGM?
Yes, he said to Louis B. Mayer, "I can afford to buy my hire my daughter a maid. I will not have her playing one."
And
Louis
B.
Mayer said, "Fine." Yes, he agreed with it because it was the time that Walter White and Wendell Willkie were in Hollywood trying to get better roles for minority people because of the war, and they were. My mother was actually a perfect storm of proving that the United States, unlike the Axis powers, was not a racist country.
Her first MGM movie was Panama Hattie. She sang Cole Porter's Just One of Those Things.
Yes.
That's starting out
billed.
At the top.
Exactly. She was not billed.
Not at all?
Not at all. And they got mail saying, "Who's the great new Latin singer?" So then her second movie role, she sang Joshua at the Battle of Jericho so they'd know she was black.
Now, the MGM kept her under contract despite the fact that they weren't giving her any roles.
Yes, well, she was very popular, and her numbers are always popular, and they wanted to keep in the good graces of the NAACP. It was wartime. There were black GIs. She was the pinup of the black GIs, the only pinup they were allowed to have.
They weren't allowed to do Betty Grable.
No, which is embarrassing to my mother, but that was it. No, she was very important in the war.
And didn't the NAACP convince her to drop out of the Johnny Mercer musical, St. Louis Woman?
Yes, they did, and she was distressed about that in the end.
Did she feel strongly about the politics of the role as the people who were advising her on it?
Well, she was very much, influenced by Paul Robeson, who was a friend of the family. Her grandmother had got him his scholarship to Rutgers. And also by W.E.B. Du Bois, who'd been madly in love with her sister. So these were family friends. It wasn't about politics so much as what are the family friends asking me to do, my grandparents' friends. And for that, she was blacklisted because of her friendships with Du Bois and Robeson.
She then married Lenny Hayden.
Yes.
Wasn't that marriage illegal in many states?
It was illegal in California. That's why they were married in Paris. In 1947, and he was the most wonderful stepfather. I adored him.
You were about 10 years old at the time.
Yes.
How did they explain that they couldn't be married in California?
They didn't explain that to me. I found that out later. They just said, "We're married, and it's a secret. Don't tell anybody." So I didn't tell anybody.
Did that mean growing up in Paris?
No, it meant growing up in New York, where there were no laws as the same. But fortunately, by 1950, that California law was struck down.
And she started performing in New York. Her live recording, Lena Horne at the Waldorf Astoria, became a best-selling album.
Yes.
Which was interesting because just a few years earlier, Jesse Owens was forced to enter the servants' entrance of the Waldorf Astoria after he had been given a ticker tape parade following the 1936 Olympics.
Yes, something happened at the Waldorf. I'm not sure what. But she was she started off at the Copacabana in 1948, and then went to the Waldorf in the 50s. So by the 50s, the Waldorf had gotten itself together.
And then she started doing a lot of television.
Yes, but then she was blacklisted from TV for 6 years or 10 years, something like that, in the 50s.
She was told, it was written into her contract, that she could not touch anyone, any of the white guests who appeared on her show.
Well, she didn't have a show. She would appear on shows, and she would know never to touch Perry Como, but Perry Como would always touch her. Which was because he didn't, you know. I mean, they knew the good people ignored that.
Were you married to Sidney Lumet when he directed your mother in what turned out to be her last movie?
Yes.
Who Is?
Yes.
That was the version with Diana Ross and,
yes.
and Michael Jackson.
Yes.
Did she? You said your mother had very little sense of politics for a long time, but she became political.
She became very political after World War II when she. She made a left turn after World War II and then got blacklisted and sort of came back from that at the end of the 50s. But she definitely was very political after World War II because of the influence of Du Bois and Robeson.
Was it her idea to return to Broadway in a one-woman show called The Lady and Her Music? She was already in her 60s.
She was in her 60s, and I think, I'm not sure whose idea it was, but my stepfather had died, my brother had died, her father had died, and Alan King, who was a cousin of Lenny's, said, get back into show business.
Lenny Hayton,
mm-hmm. Get back into show business. So she went and appeared with Alan in Westbury, New York, and then came the idea to do the show.
Was that the first time she openly discussed the discrimination she had faced in Hollywood?
On stage, yes, because she never discussed anything with her audiences before that.
The show ran for over a year.
Yes.
She won a Tony.
Yes. She won every award almost they were giving. It was a huge success.
I have to admit that I've always thought of her as being a bigger star than your book suggests. I didn't see the struggle over all the years. Lena Horne was one of the...
She was one of the big stars of my lifetime.
She
didn't struggle that much, strangely enough. Which interested me. She went from the Cotton Club to singing with Noble Sissle at the Ritz-Carlton in Boston, to marriage, to becoming a band singer with Charlie Barnett and Artie Shaw, to Cafe Society, to Hollywood at the Little Troc, where she was a huge overnight success, to the MGM contract. It was really one step, which she didn't struggle that much, funnily enough.
Your book is a combination of history and memoir. You obviously had to do a lot of research. Do you still have family living in the South?
I do. I have cousins. Not that many. I mean, my generation.
Are they Calhouns?
Well, they're not called Calhouns, but they are descendants of Calhouns, for sure.
Gail Lamette Buckley's book, The Black Calhouns, From Civil War to Civil Rights with One African-American Family, is published by Atlantic Monthly Press. It's been a great pleasure having you back on our show.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.